The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Thank you very much. Can everybody hear me? Yes? Okay. First of all, I would like to start by thanking all of the librarians, archivists, and scholars who've helped me over the last few weeks in this residency to see really just how complicated this issue is that I'm trying to deal with. And I especially want to thank the Office of State Historians for generously supporting my research here. This paper was actually very difficult to write because after being here for almost 5 weeks and working solidly on this research project and nothing else, I feel as if I'm sort of swimming underwater and not quite sure what I think anymore. So I would actually welcome your comments. Okay. The other thing I have to tell you is that I have in the slide presentation, I have some images that were TIFF files, so they're too big to show on the projector, so there are going to be some blanks in here, so please don't worry about that. So I can say quite honestly that my worst images are up here, and you have to imagine the best ones, okay? All right. In the 1920s, the American Southwest welcomed an unprecedented increase in numbers of tourists visiting the area, mostly from the Northeast, but also a significant number from the Midwest. This increase was in part owing to the widespread blanket advertising of the Santa Fe Railroad, actually the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, but commonly known by the moniker Santa Fe, that promised luxury travel, elegant hotels, and fine restaurants, both along the way and in organized detours at the end of the line, as in La Fonda, Santa Fe, the Alvarado in Albuquerque, and El Tovar at the Grand Canyon. The railroad's advertising about the Southwest was predicated on an extremely compelling narrative that was told in both words and images, and which portrayed a land of dramatic, stark, magical beauty and clear, sharp, clean light, a world in which Native people lived, isolated and removed from the sullying effects of American culture. And they lived in their original, so-called primitive state as examples of American prehistory brought to life in our very own land, and far removed from the modern world of cities, cars, the cacophony of immigrants, violent labor unions, and a fragmenting social fabric. The Santa Fe Railroad and its luxury hotels also promised easy but exclusive insider access to the crafts produced by the Native peoples visited on Indian detours, semi-private tours in luxury automobiles or buses that involved numerous leisurely stops along the way to purchase rugs, baskets, pottery, and jewelry offered for sale on several levels, ranging from museum-quality products that were individually designed, unique objects, to inexpensive, repetitively produced trinkets or curios. This is a poster of... going the wrong way. Okay, now this doesn't want to work. What have I done? Oh! There we go. Here we have some tourists on the back of a train. The visual and verbal narrative constructed by and for the interrelated systems of travel, trains, tourism, and art created a densely imbricated set of social relations that I argue framed, constructed, and ultimately created a set of cultural and national identities both among visitors, the lookers, and visited, the looked at, that ultimately came to be widely regarded as naturally occurring. I believe that vision is actually culturally constructed, much like gender or race can be culturally constructed. We see what we know. Sight, as in objects perceived by the brain, is highly selective. We see what we're taught to see and are taught that we can safely ignore or suppress the rest. And extending this argument, we act and perform socially and even culturally in the ways we are taught to act and perform. Identity can thus be framed and shaped by stereotyped constructions of identity. It's like the old saying that if you lie enough times, it becomes the truth. If you act in a certain way long enough and frequently enough, you become that person, both in the minds of others and ultimately in your own mind. In my research, I'm looking at how tourists perceived themselves in relation to the native cultures that they visited in the Southwest in the 1920s and 1930s, and how the Native American people who were visited perceived themselves. This relationship between tourists and native peoples formed an incredibly complex web of interconnectivity that can never be fully explained. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, because we find that interrogating the unknown, we learn to see things, to see more clearly things, actions, and ideas that we hadn't seen before simply because we did not know them. Sometimes we learn to see ourselves more clearly in learning to see others. So, how do we begin to unpack the cultural freight of assumptions about the relationship between tourists and native peoples in the tourist trade of 1930s New Mexico? And more importantly, what are the implications of that relationship? How is it framed, formed, and fomented? Let's step back a bit and look at some of the basic facts about the time and place for a moment, and ask, why did the Santa Fe Railroad set out to promote the Southwest as a place to visit? In the early years of the 20th century, the Santa Fe Railroad sought to consolidate its commercial dominance in the Southwest in a highly competitive, fragmented railroad system in which multiple companies competed intensely for superiority and exclusivity in freight and passenger travel. Its advertising targeted wealthy individuals hoping for a respite from the grime and grit of East Coast city life in the clear, high air and unsettled, from their point of view, pristine land of the Southwest. And its marketing strategy to flood the market with illustrated paper advertising in the form of posters and calendars. Santa Fe's calendars, by the way, went out to almost 1 million people in the early 1900s and were hung on the walls of many homes. They constructed a widespread mental image of the Southwest as an enchanted, almost fairy tale place that the rich visited and the rest of us could only fantasize about, ultimately creating a powerful cachet for those who could afford to go and who could provide visual or physical evidence of their trip when they came home. Souvenirs, then, ranging from bowls to rugs to baskets, that could be displayed in what was termed an Indian corner in wealthy homes, or exotic native dress worn by society women, became a must-have part of 1930s East Coast society. Indeed, it's often reported how artists such as Jackson Pollock and his contemporaries were influenced by Native American art, but it's less widely understood that paintings, even the supposedly commodity-rejecting American avant-garde paintings, were frequently purchased to match so-called Indian decorative schemes. The railroad, for its part, although it didn't make much money on passenger travel, also benefited from the arrangement because it parlayed the fantasy of the Southwest, as well as its reputation for pampering wealthy passengers, into a branding of the line among the rich, and ultimately a powerful advertising tool for its much more profitable freight trade. And the Southwest gained much-needed tourist dollars from the new influx of tourists at the time, especially during the Depression, when the area faced a bleak economic future without tourism. The questions driving my research are, what did tourists want to see in the Southwest? What did they see, and how and why was a myth of an enchanted Southwest constructed and performed by locals? And how and why did these performed but ultimately mythic authenticities create, construct, and transform both Native and Anglo identities in the area?
This works.
not quite sure why it's... I think maybe I should move over and just do it manually. It is. It's just, yeah. These ladies just want to stay here. There we go. If it starts just going on by itself, you can enjoy the pictures. Okay, some background information. In the first years of the transcontinental railroad travel, it was virtually impossible for a passenger to get a decent meal anywhere between the Mississippi River and the Pacific Ocean. In 1876, Fred Harvey signed on to manage the lunchroom at the Santa Fe's regular Topeka, Kansas stop. Harvey quickly renovated the Topeka lunchroom into a clean, welcoming space for weary travelers. He imported Irish linen for the tables and English silver for the cutlery. He purchased the finest possible American china, demanded that his chefs produce the best possible meals using the highest quality ingredients and of uniform quality across the system. And he charged only slightly above average prices for the service. In fact, the Santa Fe underwrote Harvey's inevitable losses because they discovered that better service translated directly into increased revenue both on the passenger train on passenger travel and in freight orders. In the next 12 years, Harvey secured the exclusive rights to operate Santa Fe-owned dining cars and luncheon restaurants and the concessions in most of the Santa Fe's hotels west of the Missouri River. Fred Harvey restaurants not only attracted new passengers to the line, but helped consolidate Santa Fe's dominance in the Southwest. It was largely because of Fred Harvey dining cars, restaurants, and hotels that the Santa Fe claimed a market niche for elegant service. And it marketed itself strategically as the line for luxury travel. It's well known that Harvey required that gentlemen wear jackets in his restaurants. He demanded polite behavior and adherence to the highest standards of conduct among all of his employees. Harvey experimented with men as waiters in his restaurants, but he found men ultimately unreliable, consequently instituting a policy of hiring only attractive young girls as waitresses, insisting that they relocate to work for him and conform to a strict code of behavior. Harvey girls, who you see here, became both the envy of and an aspiration for many young working girls along the eastern seaboard. The Harvey Girl advertisement called for, quote, young women, 18 to 30 years of age, of good character, attractive, and intelligent. At work, they had to dress in modest, formal black and white uniforms with their hair hidden under white caps and were allowed no makeup. Incidentally, but not coincidentally, the makeup business boomed in the early decades of the century as many darker-skinned immigrant women on the urban East Coast from Italy and Southern and Eastern Europe used white cake makeup and red ruby lipstick to appear more Anglo. Harvey girls were housed in dormitories. Dormitories were cared for by a house mother and earned relatively good money for a waitress in those days. As they moved west with the Harvey restaurants, Harvey girls were also required to sign a 2-year contract of employment because many of the towns in which they worked suffered a serious deficit of marriageable young women. Harvey girls were trained to be the ideal of Victorian womanhood. They were, at least publicly, pious, pure, submissive, and domestic, as described by the cult of true womanhood in the 19th century. In addition, they had good table manners and a polite attitude, and they were eminently marriageable in the minds of the upper echelons of local Western towns. Harvey girls won Harvey the moniker, the man who civilized the West. There we go. I'm sure you all recognize this. As early as 1882, Harvey began to provide food service for the Santa Fe Railroad's luxury hotel and spa at Montezuma Hot Springs near Las Vegas, New Mexico. But within a decade, he added several others, including in 1899, the Alvarado Hotel here in Albuquerque. Mary Coulter, who, surprisingly for a woman architect then, and actually nowadays still, was hired as the de facto house architect for the Santa Fe Railroad and designed the interior of the Alvarado. The reputation of the Alvarado was established as a luxury complex literally adjacent to the railroad tracks. It was literally steps away from the railway stop and train that brought tourists there in style, and it offered a friendly, comfortable interior with excellent restaurant and superior service. The building complex also included what the Fred Harvey Company called the Indian Building, a barn-like warehouse and gift shop that sold Native American arts and crafts ranging from collector and museum quality objects to modestly priced baskets and imitation lightweight souvenir trinkets. The Indian Building, managed by Herman Schweitzer, quickly became a regional hub for the trade in high-quality Native American arts and crafts, and was quite distinct from the earlier and lesser curio trade. Schweitzer amassed a major significant collection of Navajo and other Native American objects for and on behest of the Harvey Company, which he preserved, collected, and displayed and sold in the Indian Building. Schweitzer argued successfully that additional Harvey hotels should establish display areas, sales areas, and even curio shops from which to sell local Native American products. Schweitzer's connection with anthropologists, ethnographers, and other scholars working in the West validated his collecting and, by extension, the objects sold in Harvey hotels, hotel galleries and shops, and his various outlets created one of the first waves of large-scale and consistent production and marketing of directly commissioned Indian goods sold directly to consumers. Schweitzer also commissioned and sold tourist-quality souvenir imitations of Native American jewelry with unfilled silver and lighter, cheaper grades of silver and stone, and cheaper baskets and bowls in bulk for sale in Harvey Hotel shops. The impact on the local economy of the Southwest was significant. Harvey sales helped New Mexico's long-declining economy in two ways, by vastly expanding the tourist industry and by popularizing the concept of Native crafts as decorator as well as museum items. In 1900, okay, this is where it's going to get tricky. Okay, I have a bunch of photographs of El Tovar at the Grand Canyon, but they're not going to come up. So, so you just have to imagine them. In 1900, the Grand Canyon was well known nationally, but not much visited. In 1903, however, the Santa Fe Railroad extended a branch line from its primary route west from Williams, Arizona, north to the southern rim of the canyon. The railroad owned the hotel at the rim. El Tovar was and is literally steps from the end of the line, and it perches on the canyon's edge. The Fred Harvey Company had and still has the concessions license for the national park. Mary Coulter was commissioned to design several other structures at the rim, including the railroad depot. El Tovar was a luxurious 100-room complex that mimicked in its interior a mountain cabin, but was positioned adjacent to and with a drive-through connecting it to the newly built Rim Road. It also had a spectacular view of the chasm on the other side. The other buildings on the rim included Hermit's Nest, a mock ruin 5 miles to the west of the hotel, and Lookout Lodge adjacent to El Tovar. Later, Coulter was hired to expand the hotel to include Phantom Ranch. This, by the way, is Lookout Lodge. Expand the hotel to include Phantom Ranch on the floor of the canyon and the Watchtower, which you see here, more than 20 miles to the east. Another mock ruin in vaguely Native American design that was stretched over a tempered steel structure and was decorated inside by the Hopi artist Fred Cabote. But the primary attraction at the tourist's rim, aside from the scenery, that was, and El Tovar, was the Coulter-designed Hopi House. This structure, which functioned in part as a native craft gallery and gift shop for El Tovar, was positioned within steps of the hotel's entrance and took on the visual characteristics of an actual Hopi dwelling complex. In fact, it was widely advertised as being the home to several Hopi, who ostensibly lived and worked there, demonstrating the creation of their crafts, and who were claimed as its builders, although notably not its architects. El Tovar, Hermit's Lodge, the Watchtower, and the Hopi House in concert constituted a fantasy land that was part imitation rustic and frontiers-like, part imitation Native American ruin, and part fictional Native American craft workshop. The Hopi House was supposedly a living simulacrum of actual Hopi Pueblo architecture, but even today you can see that the kivas in the upper level are in fact old telegraph poles from the railroad, and they still bear the branded mark of the railroad. Hopi people were hired, actually imported, to inhabit and to display a passive, primitive, and seemingly domesticated version of so-called authentic Hopi life and costume, and they made their crafts on site as tourists watched the display of authenticity. Almost everything they made was for sale in the gift shops downstairs, and again, the objects produced ranged from very exclusive museum or collector items to relatively inexpensive tourist objects. This is a view of some. Okay. El Tovar's guests included the rich and powerful, several presidents, several foreign royals. I have a photograph. That's not going to come up. This is the Hopi House. El Tovar's guests included the rich and powerful, several presidents, foreign royals, and many of America's and the world's wealthiest and most famous people stayed there. The image that was supposed to be there. This image shows Albert Einstein did show. Okay, let's hope it stays. Albert Einstein posing with the so-called resident Native Americans and dressed up in a war bonnet. The line between authentic and fabricated was blurred, both for visitors and for the participants in the stereotype of the Hopi Indian. This performative version of expected authenticity can be termed performed authenticity and is one aspect of my research that I've been doing here. The Santa Fe Railroad also built or renovated several other luxury hotels along its line in Arizona, Kansas, California, and New Mexico in the teens and 20s, often hiring Mary Coulter as either designer or architect. In 1929, they reopened the completely renovated, refurbished, and partly rebuilt La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe. La Fonda was and still is advertised, literally, as the hotel at the end of the line, although it is no longer a Fred Harvey Company hotel or Zantera as it is now. Mary Coulter was hired to transform the old 55-room hotel into a new 156-room hotel with an addition. La Fonda became one of the first architect-designed structures and the first hotel in the region to integrate both the local Spanish and Native American heritages into a unified exterior and interior. Oh, that's a dreadful slide, sorry. Just move on. Although much modified, elements of Coulter's design are still visible today. Most of the rooms were decorated in local Spanish style, and the public places comprised an eclectic mixture now known universally as the Southwestern style. La Fonda, like the structures at the Grand Canyon, was renovated to function doubly as a luxury hotel and as a fantasy destination for tourists. Navajo rugs hung on the wall, a lecture hall that was used to instruct guests on local arts and crafts using magic lantern slides, and public spaces were decorated with traditional Native paintings, while an atrium in the center of the lobby, now a glass-ceilinged restaurant, was designed in Spanish style. The lobby area was decorated in luxurious wood paneling and almost life-size poster paintings representing highly glamorized versions of both Native American and Spanish figures. Oh, I'm sorry, I keep clicking it too much because of, hopefully it'll stay here. I actually talked to the people at El Tovar, and this is sort of an interesting, I find it interesting piece of trivia. They had T-shirts made. And they had T-shirts made of one of the Native American posters, and they had T-shirts made of this particular poster, Spanish Conquistador. And the ones with the Native American pictures sold out immediately, and they can't sell these ones at all. If you go there now, I think they're reduced to like $5. So, books on Native American cultures and places were sold in a small bookstore so that visitors could educate themselves on the people and places they would visit. And to one side of the lobby, I'm not sure if you can see that, it's very dark, a concierge informed guests about and sold tickets for La Fonda's most famous attraction, its Indian detours. The Fred Harvey Indian Detours were modeled on Koshari Tours, a small tour company that operated in Albuquerque in the 1920s, run by Erna Ferguson and Ethel Hickey, who made the somewhat contradictory claim to have personally conducted hundreds of tourists off the beaten track into the picturesque corners of the Southwest, as is often quoted in the literature on tourist theory. There is a book, there has been a book published, and the title is Off the Beaten Track, 5 million copies sold. Ferguson's description by a local newspaper as our only woman dude wrangler clearly established her intellectual superiority over her tourist clientele. She positioned herself as educated, informed, and with an inside track on the best places to buy souvenirs. In the 1920s, only a woman could have pulled off this balance between a knowledge of local Native Americans, cultivated social skills, and a keen eye for shopping. And shopping in the 19th century became essentially a female form of looking that deflected the gaze for women as they visited exhibitions and tourist destinations. In 1926, Erna Ferguson stepped in to manage La Fonda's Indian detours and to train its guides, or couriers. The training team, established by Ferguson, called the Courier Corps Advisory Board, included the notable mix of three archaeologists, one ethnographer, one historian, and one travel writer. Their job was to educate 20 young women as couriers so that they could lead tours and provide visitors with interesting and authentic information on the archaeological and ethnographic history of the Southwest. Just what exactly this mix involved is one of the things that I'm working on in these archives. So what have I found? On one hand, I've discovered an amazing synchronicity between contemporary anthropology and ethnography and the actual training of couriers. On the other hand, I'm also discovering the feminization of scholarship in the translation of Hewitt and Campbell's documents and publications into the amateur and therefore female-dominated cultural organizations in the area of the time, and then to Ferguson and her couriers. So who were the Indian Detour couriers? There they are. Like the earlier Harvey girls, couriers were expected to be pious, pure, submissive, and at least pre-domestic, that is, pretty single young women. But in addition, couriers were required also to be women whose lives have been mostly spent in the region and who have an intimate knowledge of its exceptional interest. They had to be, quote, fine, clean, thoroughbred, lively young women of old families inheriting a love and comprehension of their native state. Many couriers were actually college-educated women, but they couldn't flaunt their intelligence or knowledge in the field. They were expected to be refined, informative only in a chatty kind of way, and both friendly and accommodating. The fact that these guides were women exclusively is significant. First, they didn't threaten male tourists with their knowledge. And second, they established clear hierarchies of culture. Even Anglo women, the narrative was, were dominant and therefore intellectually superior to native men, who implicitly were read then as no threat to either Anglo men or women. The job of the courier was to entertain and educate her tour group, usually a select group of three or four tourists, and to ensure their comfort and well-being, including keeping them entertained in their roomy Packard Detour cars and serving them elaborate picnics provided and packed by the hotel. Perhaps most significant, however, couriers mediated purchases made in the field. Significantly, although men were present, okay, this is another poster, and this is a car, and you can see some of the tourists inside. Men were present. The drivers were always men. Women did the financial bargaining, which was also described as shopping. So shopping was still part of the female realm sphere or sphere of activity. When the tour returned to the hotel in the evenings, couriers also seemed to have been expected to mingle with their guests, or, as one source put it, be just a girl for the evening. Couriers wore uniforms designed to look Southwestern, but also mainstream enough to show how good native jewelry could look on an Anglo woman and with Anglo clothing. They wore relatively short skirts for the time with a walking pleat designed by an Albuquerque tailor, a velveteen blouse that was produced in several jewel colors and was loosely patterned after a Navajo blouse, thick tan stockings, sturdy walking shoes, a silver concho belt, and a squash blossom necklace, or a necklace of other distinctive Indian design, which the girl could actually choose for herself, but which had to be representative of the jewelry available for sale in the hotel gift shop. And she also wore a soft-brimmed felt hat with the Fred Harvey silver Thunderbird emblem pinned to the center front. These costumes consciously mixed a slightly bohemian Spanish style with a loosely translated Native American style, but the overall aspect was thoroughly modern and thoroughly American. The persona of the courier was thus framed by Santa Fe's two major tourist attractions of the time. The slightly bohemian dress evoked the independent thinkers of Santa Fe's art colonies and reminded tourists that art itself was available in galleries only steps from their hotel. And the vaguely Native American colors of their costume and the jewelry reminded tourists that something very similar could also be purchased in the hotel itself. Seemed to promise to make anyone look as attractive as their pretty young guide. On tours, couriers delivered carefully scripted narratives of startlingly accurate detail and description that they passed for fact. But despite precise factual accuracy, the overarching narrative of their narratives was often quite fictional, refracted by the lens of their own culture, and indeed the equally distorting lens presented by the egos of the several eminent anthropologists active in the area at the time. Another aspect of my research in the archives has been to compare the writings and lecture notes of anthropologists such as Hewitt with the lecture notes and reminiscences of the couriers themselves and the narratives of the tourist ephemera produced by the Fred Harvey Company. I don't know what I'm finding yet, but I will soon. What I'm finding so far is a surprising unanimity of voice, much more than I would have expected, and a rather seamless interweaving of all three narratives in their minds. Anthropological papers describe Indian tours in print and actually advertise for the Fred Harvey Company, while Harvey publications mimic the voices of anthropologists and raise the... And all of this raises the question, how much of our understandings of Native cultures then and even today, even among Native people themselves, has been framed and organized by people and organizations such as the Fred Harvey Company or the Santa Fe Railroad? And how much were Indian detours simply in-field versions of the Hopi House? Like the Hopi House, Indian detours marketed the fantasy that tourists could observe Native Americans in their ancient and original state, but without danger or even discomfort to self, and that they could purchase crafts directly from them, unmediated and absent of commercial markups. In contrast to those tourists who relied on Native people bringing their wares to sell by the side of the train, detourists saw themselves as pioneers of sorts, who gained an authentic off-the-beaten-track experience without the discomfort. Many detourists seem to have been either unaware or unwilling to acknowledge that their tour was strategically staged, that dances that were performed... This is some purchases being made. Dances... that were performed expressly for them and at the behest of the courier and for every other tour group that came through. They wanted to believe in the fiction that the blankets were woven, the pottery thrown, and the jewelry crafted specifically for sale to them. They seemed to equate the detour with a way of identifying with a myth and a fantasy, especially when they saw their own fantasy characters like Mary Pickford, in the same glamorous situations as themselves. Indian detour publicity brochures confirm this fantasy. They say, "Our Southwest is at once the last frontier and the home of an ageless antiquity. In it, the American reads his history, whose origin is lost in the past that was old before the beginning of the Christian era. It is the purpose of the Indian detour to take you through the very heart of all of this, to make you feel the lure of the real Southwest that lies beyond the pinched horizons of your train window." And there's the train. The tourist narrative crafted by Indian detours focused on the originality and great age and long history of Native cultures, but it also spelled the inevitability of its disappearance as incapable of existing within the myth of a recent, intellectual, cultured Western European society, and therefore were described as the vanishing race. The Native American so-called simplicity was equated with a childlike innocence and an incapability of taking care of themselves or to function fully in American culture. Several stereotypes were employed to shore up the belief that Native Americans were unidimensional, not fully rounded human beings, and to limit their agency in society. The better... from the viewpoint of visitors, Indians were inevitably described as those most domesticated, those who were most settled and most passive, and therefore of no threat. This role was frequently ascribed to Pueblo Indians, who were stereotyped as feminized, passive, pure, and domestic. Indeed, Pueblo society was often described both in words and images as being female dominated, as if to make the men appear even more cowed. Navajo were described as warriors, interesting from a distance but not to be trusted entirely up close, and thus not quite domesticated or civilized. The Apache were often described as untamable and therefore to be avoided. The Indian tours actively produced, constructed, and created, and then promoted with railroad advertising, performed with safe trained Indians who did not mind being gazed upon by visitors, an original ancient authenticity that was domesticated for tourist consumption, was safely and comfortably accessible to wealthy tourists by train and car, and was pleasurable to visit even by, quote, this is from the Fred Harvey literature, even by the laziest person. The performed authenticity of Indian culture was a product of a complicity among the railroad, hotels, perky young couriers, Native American craftspeople and performers, and the tourists themselves. The package was a living fantasy of America before the fall, with no Great Depression, no labor disputes, no teeming cities filled with poverty and violence, no filthy, disruptive workers, no enclaves of unintelligible immigrants, no outspoken women clamoring for the vote or worse, men's jobs, and no one who made the wealthy tourist feel guilty for spending money freely on luxury travel, a fantasy vacation with exotic accommodations and food, and on exotic Native American arts and crafts. In sum, La Fonda, the Indian detours, and their like, offered an affirmation of the right of the wealthy, self-defined center of the United States, to claim their place in that center and to relax and enjoy both self-satisfaction and an uninterrogated status quo. In 1904, Fred Harvey's... In 1904, Fred Harvey's ethnographic fantasy, The Hopi House, was installed with many other Indian exhibits at the St. Louis World's Fair, which celebrated the bicentennial of the Louisiana Purchase. Coulter's simulacrum of the Hopi House at St. Louis, by this time twice removed from actual Hopi culture, was built in the center of a one-acre park on which imported Native Americans, not all of whom were Hopi, worked for almost a year. One can only imagine how grim that was. The St. Louis Fair was modeled on the 1893 Chicago's World Fair, in which fairgrounds and the world were divided into the white city on one half, a clean, orderly, white place that housed the exhibits of the so-called civilized nations, and the midway, on the other side, a disorderly chaos of crafts, foods, and entertainment, provided by the, quote, uncivilized nations, all of which visitors could preside over from the height of the very first Ferris wheel, which stood between the two. The Hopi village at St. Louis performed a new narrative. The uncivilized was tame, domesticated, and contained within clearly demarcated intellectual and actual spaces. And this is what the Fred Harvey Company also gave Indian detourists. Both the Hopi House and Indian detours located the power of the gaze safely with the tourist. They provided a safe, comfortable stage from which to enjoy tourist scopophilia by providing a picturesque, primitive people in a living museum in an exotic land, where Native American men were no longer dangerous warriors, but were now farmers and helpers for women, and where women were domesticated homebodies who fed, cared for children, and functioned in many ways. If I can find, I'm sorry, the image is gone, as a kind of Christian Madonna-like strength of tower of strength, patience, and suffering. The pleasure of the experience for the tourist derived from the apparent reification of the tourist's right to claim the upper hand in an already unbalanced power relationship. As one contemporary author put it, today everyone seemed to possess, quote, their own pet culture. Thus, American colonialism and an incipient American imperialism was played out in the Southwest in the 1930s, in which the colonizer both despised the savageness and admired the childlike simplicity of the colonized, and the colonized both hated, resented, and grudgingly admired and imitated the culture of the colonizer. Many tourists who enjoyed the Hopi House and Indian tours valued the experience because it allowed them to displace and sublimate their fears about American culture in the 1920s and 30s. The fear of the dangerous other presented by the immigrants and workers and so forth, an increasing fear of violence from abroad in the 1930s, and a new uncertainty about what it meant to be an American. On the East Coast, the imagined identity of real Americans played out in places such as Colonial Williamsburg, where an Anglo-American fantasy past was, and still is to a large extent, presented as the American identity. And, incidentally, was created by Rockefeller just after he abandoned hope of creating something similar using Native American cultures in the Southwest. The desire to construct the fiction of the ethnographic present of a performed national past in Colonial Williamsburg really isn't so different than the performed authenticity of the Hopi House and the Indian Detour, except in Williamsburg, the actors get to go home every night. Dean McCannell has described six stages of sacralization or staged authenticity, what he calls the museumization of a people. Several apply to the discourse of tourism in the Southwest in the 1930s. They are naming, as in the representation of the Southwest in railroad advertising, framing in which a front region is cosmetically decorated with reminders of back region activities or mementos to give it atmosphere, as in the Indian building in Albuquerque, elevation in which the front region is totally organized to look like a back region, as in the Hopi House, and enshrinement, in which a back region is open to outsiders, as in the Indian Detours. The final stages are mechanical reproduction and social reproduction, the production of tourist pamphlets, guidebooks, and brochures, and ultimately a hybrid culture based on inherited and constructed identities, usually not of one's own making. The Southwest of the imagination was manipulated into a powerful concept in the 1950s when Walt Disney visited the Hopi village, reimagined once again in the center of a railroad fair in the Midwest. Disney was in the early stages of design for Disneyland in Anaheim at the time, and was clearly inspired by the Indian village. Disney contracted with the Santa Fe Railroad to construct a single-gauge railroad to allow visitors to travel around the perimeter of Disneyland, literally viewing or gazing at the park from above, and he even named the Santa Fe cars after peoples in the Southwest. He modeled the train station in Disneyland on the train station at the Grand Canyon. And finally, one of Disneyland's first major diorama rides was the Grand Canyon ride, designed and painted in part by some Harvey employees. Most visitors to Disneyland then and now experience Disney's performance of the Southwest as a hyper-real manifestation without a source. The issue at hand is not only did the Hopi House have a source, but that source was manipulated and distorted for consumption to the extent that its identity has bled into actual Native American identity, and the construction threatens to become reality. In reading all of this over this morning before I came here, I was struck by the inadequacy of this paper. I could leave it there, to cover many of the ideas and issues that govern this book-length project that I'm engaged in, and to demonstrate how many new ideas are percolating in my brain after my residency here. I am eager to explore the process by which tourists actually worked or learned to objectify the Native Americans they visited, how couriers worked with both constituencies. I found lengthy Christmas lists, for instance, of one courier who gave sometimes not so small gifts to both adults and children in the various pueblos that she visited on her detours. What prompted that? How was the complex mix of patronization blended with real affection? I want to explore further the concept of the visual geography and of power relations in sight. How did the city, the town, the exposition site, the Hopi House, and the Indian detour both frame and craft looking and the gaze? Also a very complex and often more subtle than we think set of power relations. I also need to interrogate more fully issues of national and cultural identities and how they function in the complex web of human relations, as well as how they are always fluid and in flux, how they change with time and place, especially when divergent communities confront one another and the power relation is unequal. I want to explore further the historiography of anthropology in this area and how it transacted with and was acted upon by tourist conceptualizations of people and place. And I want to look further at the issue of colonialism, post-colonialism, and how it impacts power relations. There are many forms of colonial coercion. It is not just about military might. It is also about political and social coercion, too, and it also involves economic coercion. What does it mean to be coerced into certain behaviors because of financial need and financial dependency formed and framed by the colonizer? The issue of gaze is also central to my work since it helps define and describe visual power relations. How do we look? How do we establish these hierarchies with and through our gaze? How do those gazed upon deflect or reflect the gaze or gaze back at the objectifying viewer? And what are the multifarious forms of resistance to that gaze and its attempts to establish, enforce, and reinforce power relations? There's an old joke in Ireland, where I come from, a country which is with not such dissimilar issues of colonialism and resistance. The joke is, one man draws a circle on the ground and makes another stand inside that circle. If the man steps out, he will beat him. The first man goes about his business for the rest of the day, but every time he looks at the man in the circle, the second man starts laughing uproariously. After some time, the first man asks the second why he keeps laughing, and the second says, "Every time you turn your back, I step outside the circle." That's the kind of resistance that I'm trying to pinpoint. So finally, I want to make sure in this project that I don't portray one side of this transaction as the brute aggressor and the other side as the hapless victim, because words and images create meaning and memory. If I, as a scholar, forget that and begin to think that I am actually explaining history or revealing grand truths, then I'm doing exactly what the anthropologists, railroads, hoteliers, tour guides, and couriers did in the Southwest in the 1930s. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Oh, yes.
In the beginning, when you
introduction, you talked about the tourists, how they perceive themselves, and the Native Americans, and how they perceive themselves. And I think you did a fantastic job of dealing with the tourists and how they perceive themselves. And I really appreciated the Irish joke at the end, because I'm wondering to what extent you feel you might be able to do that on the Native American side. Because it seems like a lot of these performances are really constructed for what the Native American group feels the tourist wants
to see.
And
yeah.
What's behind the scene? Like
how
could you ever, you know, begin to reflect on that?
Right. I don't. The honest answer is I don't know yet, but the yet is important, and I think that's absolutely crucial to this research. Otherwise, it simply becomes another sort of restatement of everything that's been said already through one lens. So what I try to do in a lot of my research is try to kind of, you know, I look through my eyes. And then I try to imagine what it would be like if I sort of took one step to the side and looked through a different lens with a different set of eyes. And so I sort of try to work in from the sides. And frankly, my research methods, as some of you here know, is to gather, just gather mounds and mounds and mounds of information, and then look at it all. And because I'm an art historian and a visual person, what I like to do is just spread it out all on the floor and see where the gaps are, see where the holes are. So that was a very long answer to a great question. And the answer is, I don't know yet, but I would really, really like to try to find out. I don't think I'll find out as much as I want to, but I would like to try. Yeah.
People talking about selling their work, what it was like, and so you can get that firsthand native voice that way. And then there are people still alive at some different places, like Tessie and Alamo, who can talk about their experience firsthand. Say, you know, Tessie talks about her mother going on the train, and they were so little they were afraid the train would sort of eat their mother up. And she's in, I guess, her early 60s. So there's a rich, it's still decent enough.
That it's. And actually, I'm hoping to do that. This research trip and this residency, I'm really in the beginnings of this project, and I'm just trying to sort of frame the ideas and find out where the big gaps are, and that clearly is one that, and thank you very much for that reference. Yeah.
In conversation also with what you mentioned, I was wondering if in the bigger project you're going to talk about Indian education at this time in the United States, because two things pop to mind automatically for me is that Native people's relationship to the train is also troubled by the fact that trains is how children were forcibly removed to other parts of the country to go to, like, Carlisle Indian School or even to Sanibel Indian School, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part of this is thinking about how Native people from other parts of the country were being brought to Santa Fe and being taught certain art forms that are place-based. So I'm automatically drawn to think about, like, Oscar Howe, who was named in Dakota, and his art form, and how he actively resisted the Santa Fe style of art, because for him it wasn't place-based, it wasn't where he was from tribally. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a really interesting conversation about how he, in the 1930s and 40s, starts to critique Indian education in Santa Fe, and also, like, the influence of the consumerism and how it's influencing traditional arts. But what's really ironic is that Oscar Howe then creates, or is part of the creation of, the Corn Palace in Mitchell, South Dakota.
Right.
Huge forest.
Yeah.
Amazing
place.
Sorry,
I was scribbling all that down. No, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the fellows on this program gave a great talk the other day on sort of the Indian school and education. And I think it's absolutely crucial. You know, education forms you socially, because, you know, you go away and as a five-year-old and you're in this social sphere for a lot of time during the day, and especially if they were taken away to boarding schools and things. It's really a kind of, I think re-education project is maybe too much, but sort of like that.
Well, it also challenges this idea that it moves beyond Native people simply admiring and imitating dominance.
Yeah.
And goes into actually talking about how colonization works, right?
Yeah.
People feared mm-hmm. for their lives. People.
Yeah.
It was actually mm-hmm. an act of violence. And so it moves beyond that in terms of why we started to imitate and why
yeah.
we started, you know, working within frames of cultural ambivalence, because a lot of times it was beyond our choice.
Sorry, writing all this time. Thank you. I think that's.
No, this is fascinating.
I think it's really an important part. Yeah, yeah. If you have any good references for me, that would be fabulous. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much.